From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is anything different? It's day 19 of the partial government shutdown, the day after President Trump made the case for his border wall in his Oval Office address last night.
To every member of Congress, pass a bill that ends this crisis. To every citizen, call Congress and tell them to finally, after all of these decades, secure our border.
And Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi had this response. Here's Schumer.
Most presidents have used Oval Office addresses for noble purposes. This president just used the backdrop of the Oval Office to manufacture a crisis, stoke fear, and divert attention from the turmoil in his administration.
Did anyone move the needle in Congress? NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis is here. And Sue, what are you hearing on Capitol Hill?
The House Democrats met this morning in behind closed doors to talk about the president and the next steps. I talked to one Democrat, Bill Pascrell. He's a Democrat from New Jersey, and this is what he had to say.
We want to get the government open. That's pressure. We all should feel that. But we're not going to give our souls away. We're not going to do that. And we're going to stand pretty damn firm.
Not going to give our souls away. I think that's kind of captures how Democrats' mood is on this. They are pretty dug in. They do not see any political vulnerability here in terms of the wall and whether they should negotiate over it. Their position as of this morning, and the day is still unfolding here, is that there will be no compromise on the wall, that their position is vote to reopen the government, and then we will have negotiations on border security.
You know, it strikes me we have gone to the level of the soul because the Democrats using that word, the president used it last night. You know, saying that the hearts and souls are broken for some of the humanitarian stories. But here's Adam Kinzinger, the Republican congressman from Illinois, speaking on CNN this morning.
This is like a super easy issue to solve. And this is what just frustrates me out here is we can all solve this. And it's like an 80% agreement with when we're done. It's just nobody wants to give anybody a win or anything else. We got to get past that. Or we're going to continue in this stupid shutdown idiocy cycle for the rest of our time out here. And that's got to stop.
Super simple. But
he's got a point.
He's painting it as many Americans are, as two sides dug in. But are you hearing any Republicans say off the record that they don't think the president's idea of a crisis at the border is a winning strategy? Or do you hear any Democrats whispering, you know, the president told pretty compelling stories of the few people who have lost loved ones to violent migrants. We don't want to be blamed for that. In other words, are you hearing anyone off the record?
Well, I would say even on the record, I think there is a lot of acknowledgement up here that there is an increasing unease that we are allowing hundreds of thousands of federal workers to go without pay and many other implications of the shutdown being held up because of the wall. And these are a lot of unrelated people being tied to this. And I do think that you are hearing a bit of angst on the Republican side, particularly in the Senate, among some Senate moderates over there saying, you know, maybe we can open up some of these agencies of government that are completely unrelated to the Homeland Security Department, completely unrelated to the border issue at hand, and get people paid and back at work. I think this Friday is another pressure point in this ongoing back and forth. January 11th is a payday for a lot of federal workers. And the longer people go without pay, the more I think lawmakers are sensitive to the needs of people that are essentially just caught in the crosshairs here, that have nothing to do with the underlying argument over what to do at the border.
I'm wondering too, Sue, if you're hearing from lawmakers, particularly on the Republican side, about, you know, how fact checkers are having a field day with the president's comments. He never last night mentioned terrorists coming across the border because that theory was pretty roundly shot down by his own State Department. But he did talk about drugs coming across, crime. Of course, there is some of both. But fact checkers today saying most drugs come through legal entry points. Immigrant and migrant communities have lower rates of crime. Are you hearing any concern about how the picture is getting painted?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that Republicans on Capitol Hill are looking to the president to define the strategy here and define the argument. And last night was a good example of how that is still kind of jumbled. The president has been making a case for the wall, but it has largely always been a political case. You know, this really is a campaign promise for him that he's trying to make good on. He is vacillating between whether it's a humanitarian crisis or a national security crisis or a drug crisis. And I think that makes it a lot harder for the rank and file in the party to defend him. I still think, though, that the president is incredibly popular among Republicans and that the wall as a campaign promise is still something a lot of his supporters really are behind him on. And there isn't quite yet much movement among Republicans on Capitol Hill to find a lot of daylight between the president on this. They still want to be seen as his allies on the wall and not as his critics.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now to Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And what do you think of this moment right now after you watched the president's speech last night? We heard the Democratic response to it. Where are we at this moment, especially as an historian looking back at this? And this is almost about to be our longest shutdown ever.
Well, the unbelievable part is to hear the president make his case based on so many things that were not true, not grounded in the facts that his own administration puts forward. But the more predictable part is this is partisanship playing out. The key point right now is Republicans are sitting still and sitting behind the president, even though some privately understand that the longer this goes on, the steeper the political price they might have to pay for this shutdown.
You think they will continue to stick by him?
Well, a few have bolted, but a few is not enough to override a presidential veto. I do think there's a point in which partisanship will work against the president, meaning Republicans will say it's not in their interest to support him. That's always the greatest threat that he faces. But at this point, I don't see when that happens. I think we're still in a moment that's pretty safe for the president within his own party.
Which is interesting because, as you point out in your piece in the New York Times, the president is actually a pretty weak president right now when it comes to his popularity, the fact that he won the presidency but didn't win the popular vote. And yet Republicans are sticking by him and he is able to use the power of the presidency in pretty significant ways.
That's exactly right. He certainly uses it in terms of his ability to shape the national debate. He just did that in the last 2 days, right through now, where this is what we're talking about. He's been able to count on this very strong partisan loyalty to do what he needs to do without any kind of reprimand from his own party. And finally, the out might be he agrees to fund the government and turns to the emergency powers of the president, that executive presidential power, as a way to at least try to get the funding that he desires. So I think in many ways, presidential power might be the next step that he is looking to lean on to get what he wants.
What would that mean if he did that? Would that lead to a constitutional crisis if he used his own executive power to use basically military funding to build the wall?
Well, it would certainly lead to a challenge in the courts. That's without any question. And it doesn't seem like it would be a strong case to say this is an emergency that could justify these kinds of powers. But we'll see. And it could also lead to a clash with Congress, where under 1976 legislation, the House and then the Senate will have the ability to push back against that. So I don't know if it'll be a constitutional crisis. There are actually mechanisms to deal with him doing that, and we'll see if they play out.
What do you make of another column in the New York Times that's gotten a lot of attention the last few days from David Leonhard, who says basically the country would be better off impeaching Trump, removing him from office, then allowing the voters to decide what happens in a couple of years because he's causing so much damage to the country?
Well, I think there might be a case. I do think we need to wait. We need to see what the Mueller report says. I think we need to know what the courts find on these many other issues the president is now being investigated for. But to rule out impeachment is as big a mistake as it is to simply say move forward rapidly with impeachment. This is a legitimate process. There are very legitimate concerns about large-scale corruption in this administration. And if the facts point that way, I think the House Democrats will have no choice other than to start that impeachment process.
The only president who's ever resigned from office, as we've talked about with you before, is Richard Nixon. How do you see this moment now compared to that one, given all that's happened in the last many months?
It's pretty bad. I think if you collectively look at all the charges that this president is facing, both from the 2016 election to conflict of interest and obstruction charges to issues involving his business, they really are starting to add up. We are clearly in Nixonian territory, and I would argue if all this was true, we are even in a more severe situation. So in some ways, President Trump might end up overshadowing Nixon. We'll see. But I don't think it's unreasonable to start talking that way.
Well, do you think that this shutdown is going to be seen as some sort of a turning point in the Trump presidency?
It might be. The reason it would be is if it starts to have the effect of shaking that Republican support for the president. Again, not for principle, but for politics. They see this is too costly for them. If he loses support among Senate Republicans, he's in big trouble. That's his firewall, even more than Fox News. And so the question is, does the shutdown hurt him? He's already unpopular. So it's really, does it affect his popularity with congressional Republicans?
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and co-author with Kevin Cruz of the new book Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
A poll out this month from the University of Michigan finds 45% of adults aged 50 to 64 are worried they won't be able to afford insurance in retirement. Another 19% decided to stay in their current job rather than changing jobs or retiring just to keep their health coverage. But often as Americans age, it's up to their kids to handle questions of finances and health care. One woman who found herself in this situation is now helping guide others. Joining us now is Christine Dodd, chief executive and founder of Elder Navigator, a company that helps people with elder health care decisions in Northeast Ohio. Christine, welcome.
Hello, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Well, and it sounds like you have learned a lot from your own journey caring for your mom and dad. I understand your dad passed away in October, so our condolences.
Thank you.
For your loss. What happened with your dad, and how did you fit into it?
Well, my dad was healthy and active in August, and they found, however, after some back pain, some lesions on his pancreas, which required surgery, which then was diagnosed as pancreatic cancer. Although my father successfully survived the surgery, there were myriad complications in the surgery after the surgery, and he quite honestly didn't die of pancreatic cancer. He died of infections like C. diff and sepsis at the hospital that were unrelated to the surgery, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm. And you were with them along the way?
I was with my father for 9 weeks, 10 hours a day. I have my own business, so I was fortunate to have some flexibility to be there.
And now you're caring for your mom?
Yes. My mom has a rare autoimmune disorder, which so far so good, but we are navigating ourselves through two departments at the Cleveland Clinic right now.
And your mom is how old at this point?
73.
Mm-hmm. And your father was?
73.
Uh-huh.
So still relatively young.
Still relatively young, yeah. And you didn't see any of this coming?
No, my dad had some back pain, which turned into pancreatic cancer a few weeks later.
And you have experience as a healthcare lawyer, but even you felt lost when making the best decisions on healthcare for your parents.
Yeah, I'm a healthcare lawyer, and I worked in the House and Senate writing some of the healthcare laws myself when I was a bit younger. And I found it very difficult to navigate this complex system. And I had good relationships and contact with the nurses on a daily basis, so I could gather as much information as I needed. But after talking to friends and colleagues who've gone through this, you do feel pretty helpless and alone through most of the process.
What is the toughest part of this? Is it the insurance companies? Is it just coordinating with different doctors or what?
I think it's coordinating with different doctors is a real challenge. My dad had a team. And one thing I didn't know, and part of the reason I was there all the time, is you really need to be there at 7 a.m. when the doctors start their rounds to get the information. The nurses can give you updates, but the doctors typically round at 7 and 5:30. And also, you need to find out if the insurance company covers a skilled nursing facility, for example. And so there are insurance challenges as well.
And so you have started a business that helps people do exactly this.
Yeah. My dad's journey inspired me to want to help others. And I set up a business, Elder Navigator, which helps from patient appointments to the inpatient stay to discharge planning. I wrote a newspaper article about my journey that was actually published the day my dad died. I've got a lot of feedback from that. I think we're all going to be caregivers if we're not already. And so I think the article and the subject really resonates.
You pointed out in that article that you noticed a woman who had no family members to help her. That must be a common situation as well.
Yes, we were at a cancer center in Cleveland where my dad was recovering, and I noticed a lot of people, one lady in particular, did not have anyone to help her. There's a new trend of people out there called elder orphans, which, you know, don't have children nearby or spouses. Some of the children are working late and managing their own children and are part of the sandwich generation, so it's difficult for them to get to the hospital.
The sandwich generation, what does that mean?
It's people like my sister who was caring for little children as well as elder parents at the same time, as well as working. So they're kind of sandwiched between responsibilities.
That's Christine Dodd, who is chief executive and founder of Elder Navigator. That's a company that helps people make decisions about health care for elderly people in Northeast Ohio. Christine, thank you.
Thank you.
And now let's bring in Joe Coughlin, director of MIT's Age Lab. He's author of The Longevity Economy, Unlocking the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. Joe, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
So first of all, how common is it for people to think that their spouse or a family member is just going to take care of all these things when they get sick late in life and that they don't have to plan ahead?
Well, there's actually a twofold answer to that. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, most of us can see ourselves dead before we can see ourselves needing care. Mm. So one of the problems with having a caregiver or planning ahead is we really don't see ourselves needing it in the future. But when we do, we kind of loathe the idea that our children would have to step in and, frankly, not wanting to be a burden to our family either.
So therefore, should you go out and try to find somebody to help you navigate this, even if you are totally healthy and fine?
It's interesting. Retirement planning, especially as the population ages, is becoming a greater and greater issue. But we only focus on the money element, and of course that's necessary. But yes, we need to start planning ahead for how will we receive care? Who do we want to provide it? How will we pay for it? And what will the quality be?
And how big is the industry when you look out there and see all the options available to you?
It's interesting. There is an industry, but it is highly fragmented. I would argue that most of the, shall we say, formal caregivers, the social workers, the nurses and the like, believe it or not, are mostly mom and pop shops. Hmm. There are some large franchises out there. But the diversity of care and the different needs that you will have makes it an incredible challenge for anyone to integrate all these services and systems and administration that goes with it.
So how do you go about finding somebody that you can trust to help you?
Well, the first thing is you have to ask yourself, what is the job you're trying to get done? Is it coordination of specialists and pharmacists and treatments in the hospital? Then you're going to be looking for someone who's probably a nurse or a former nurse from that system. So they don't just understand it, but they actually know the people. Is it about staying at home? Then maybe you'd want somebody who specializes in social work and being able to do an assessment of the house to make sure that the person can stay there healthy and longer. And is it about technology? Well, believe it or not, there are certain commercial companies that are now coming out there to be able to come into your home, do an audit, and to install the technologies necessary. So unfortunately, the biggest job for caregiving, which tends to be the oldest adult daughter, is navigating the system.
Navigating the system in what ways? What is difficult that we wouldn't know just from basic knowledge, but that we would need to know at that point?
Well, unfortunately, aging is not for wimps, and it gets much more complicated as we age. And so, for instance, most of us are used to the idea of just going to see our doctor. Mm-hmm. And with any luck, we just need that one doctor and we're good. But with the average older adult having two or three, maybe four chronic conditions, that could be two or three or four or more specialists. So what's complicated is getting the doctors to talk to the doctors. The fact that you're taking multiple medications that need to be taken at the right time and the right dose with the right meal and the like. So suddenly it's not just about the care itself, but think about the administration that goes with it. Who's paying and the like.
Well, and you haven't mentioned insurance companies, and that's got to be a big part of it too, is trying to navigate that and make sure that everything gets paid for.
And as an adult child, there's nothing more fun than explaining to an elderly loved one who does not want any bills on their table to show them a bill from the insurance company says, this is not a bill. But at the bottom, it says, you owe $800.
Uh-huh. And I imagine that many people who are in this situation are going to be able to rely on Medicare Does that cover everything? Or
no, Medicare covers a great deal. Mm-hmm. It does not cover everything. In fact, it may not cover certain specialties. It may not also cover the quality of care that you think your spouse or loved one deserves.
How much more are you going to have to pay for somebody to help you navigate all of this?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a whole new field, or not very new, but new because it's becoming more aware in the country because of the aging population of care managers, geriatric care managers, or many are called now life care managers. They've been around since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But the hourly rate for some of these services can be as low as $35 or $45 per hour. I have seen them be well over $245 an hour.
Are the costs of the caregivers covered by insurance?
The cost of caregivers, unfortunately, in most cases are not. There are some, but in most cases, it is out of pocket.
So what advice would you have for someone who is looking for an aging life care manager?
I think one of the first things we can do is, I write in the longevity economy, is older adults, and by the way, that's a lot younger than most people think, in their 40s and 50s, if you will, should start thinking about how would they want care, to identify the care services that they would like, but also to have a frank discussion with their spouse and with their adult children as to what they would like, what they do not like, and how they're going to be able to afford it. But I would also look beyond the care about medication and food and bathroom breaks and everything like that, to also think about what are the technologies I can put into the home to enable me to stay in my house longer. So planning is more important than almost anything else.
And a lot of the new technologies that we're seeing are really helpful. You know, you think about something like Alexa or these smart speakers, and the way that I use them versus the way that somebody who can't move as much would use them, they really are very helpful.
Absolutely. My colleagues at the MIT Age Lab are looking at the Internet of Things, where your house is going to be monitoring, managing, and motivating good behaviors at any age.
So have you done all the things you're telling us?
I have done only a few of them. So yeah, I'm saying do as I say, not as I have done yet. But do imagine this, though. 1 in 4 American families are providing upwards of 26 to 29 hours a week in elder care. This is a private problem with profound public implications.
That is Joe Coughlin, director of MIT's Age Lab. His book is The Longevity Economy, Unlocking the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Roughly 2,000 U.S. schools still have Native American mascots, even though the American Psychological Association called for the retirement of those usually cartoonish symbols in 2005 because they so negatively impact Indigenous children's mental health and self-esteem. Well, one of those schools, Neshaminy High School in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, whose teams and mascot have the same name a Washington NFL team has, and we're only going to say it once because Redskin is a racially offensive description to so many Native Americans. At a series of hearings this week, there's a battle over whether to retire the name and the mascot that goes with it. Let's bring in WHYY reporter Aaron Moselle. Aaron, this battle isn't new in this town. It's been simmering for years. So what prompted the hearings?
So this all ties back to a complaint that was filed with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission by a parent. And she complained that using the mascot was creating sort of a hostile educational environment. The parent eventually, she kind of voluntarily withdrew her complaint, and then the commission kind of took up the case after that and sued the district.
Okay, and here we are. Now, of the witnesses testifying, there's Andre Bilodeau. He's executive director of an organization called the Native American Guardians Association. They are about protecting, they say, positive Native American images in mainstream. There are some Native Americans in the group, we understand. He is not one of them, but he spoke in favor of the district keeping the name. Let's listen.
There's many variations of Redskin. The objective use to describe a painted warrior is specific to Neshaminy, nothing more. You can misuse the term fruitcake. I can give you a fruitcake at Christmas, but if I walk into a mental hospital and I shout out fruitcake or call somebody That's offensive.
So there he is representing this group that it's interesting. They are trying to keep these symbols. Who else are we hearing from in the hearings?
So far, Bill Lideau has sort of been the only one in support of the district's stance, which is to keep the mascot. Otherwise, we've kind of heard from a teacher, for example, yesterday, and also a former student who was a student editor, while there was this whole debate about whether or not student editors could ban the word for the school mascot from the school newspaper. Her name is Jillian McGoldrick. And she said that she was on the receiving end of a lot of, you know, angry messages from parents as a result of her group's decision.
I was 16 and my name was being used by parents in the district that I was like some awful human being. I was 16 years old and I would log on to social media and see that.
We're reading that at the time she was suspended from her job as editor of the paper for a month. A teacher who supported her was suspended for 2 days without pay. This is a very serious issue there. But as we say, psychologists say there's research to support that it seriously negatively impacts Indigenous children. Is there any sense that there might be some compromise here? I'm thinking of the University of Utah, the Utah Utes sports team. They worked with the Tribal Council of the Ute Tribe in 1996. They dropped an American Indian symbol and replaced it with a red-tailed hawk swoop. Is there any sense that the people in town attached to this symbol might budge?
I don't get that sense. I mean, I've been covering this controversy for a while now, and the folks who support the use of the mascot, they're extremely loyal to this symbol. And for them, it's also just not a racist symbol. Mm. They just don't see it as a problem. Mm. To them, it is honoring Native American culture.
That's Aaron Mozell, reporter for WHYY. So we might see this case go pretty far in the court system. We'll keep an eye on it. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back to our top story now. President Trump is meeting with lawmakers today after his push for the border wall last night. Democrats have put forth bills to reopen the government without funding the wall, which they say is expensive and ineffective. Joining us now is Republican Congresswoman Debbie Lesko of Arizona. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
So as this shutdown is in its third week, what do you think now after last night's speeches? What's going to happen? And is there anything you think Republicans will compromise on?
Well, I think who knows exactly what's going to happen, but I really hope that the Democrats get serious about coming to the negotiating table. Our leadership, who has been in these meetings at the White House with the Democrat leadership, had said that the first meeting, Speaker Pelosi and Schumer just wouldn't even listen to Secretary Nielsen about any of the border facts at all. They're coming into these meetings not willing to compromise one single bit. And as you've heard repeatedly, the Republicans and President Trump are willing to compromise, but we need to have the border secured. And that's what this is about.
But Democrats have said that the wall is not the most effective way to secure the border, that it could be done with technology, more border agents, all kinds of other things that it's been proven, even though we do have wall in many parts of the border or fencing, that's not the most effective way to spend the taxpayer dollars.
Well, I think we need all of the above, including a fence. I call it a fence because I have never been under the presumption that it was going to be a concrete or block wall necessarily. But we need a barrier. I went down in October to the Nogales border and met with Customs and Border Patrol officials and the agents. And I asked them outright, do you need a fence? And they said, yes. And the numbers tell that fences work. I mean, in Yuma, Arizona, for instance, the fence was built in 2005, and illegal traffic has dropped 95% over those 9 years. This is part of the solution. In fact, I put out a border security plan, which included a fence, but also included more funding for agents, more funding for technology. And if I heard correctly last night, which I believe I did, the president wants all of those. The fence is just part of the plan.
But if the fence is just part of the plan, then why shut down the government over just part of the plan? Why not just do all the other things and then we'll figure out the fence later?
Well, because the Democrats will never agree. For instance, last year during the congressional session, Republicans came up with two really good solutions to immigration problems. The first one would have not only provided funding for border security, but it also, as a compromise with the Democrats, said, we will allow the DACA recipients to stay here legally. Not one Democrat voted for it. So we have tried repeatedly to get the Democrats to come to the negotiating table, and so far they are totally unwilling. And I was sent here to stand up for my constituents, and I will continue to stand up for not only my constituents, but the safety and welfare of all U.S. citizens.
What about the 60,000 federal government workers in the state of Arizona working now without the promise of a paycheck because of this fight? What do you say to them?
I say I feel it's awful. It's awful. And that's why I voted for on December 20th. Funding to keep the government open. Unfortunately, as you know, it passed out of the House with just Republicans. No Democrats voted for it. Unfortunately, as you know, in the Senate, they have the 60-vote rule, and we don't have 60 Republicans. So you need some Democrats to get on board. We've been told over and over again the Democrats will not budge. They will not even come to the negotiating table.
But you won't budge on the issue of wall funding. You would not support opening the government without the $5 billion for the wall specifically.
I want to see if they have a plan. If the Democrats have a plan, I am a reasonable person. If they came back and said, okay, we don't want to give you $5.7 billion, but we're willing to give $3 billion, you know, hey, I might say yes to that.
You're in the House, but do you have confidence in Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, to get the country out of this shutdown? Because a lot of this is in his hands at this point.
I think it's actually in the Democrat hands. I think it's in Schumer's hands. Republicans have repeatedly been willing to compromise. It was in media reports. I wasn't in this meeting that President Trump said that he was willing to come down on the dollar amount. Democrats won't even come up with a counteroffer.
What would you think if the president did what he didn't do last night, but has talked about doing, which is to declare a state of emergency and bypass Congress and build the wall himself?
Well, I hope we don't come to that, because I think that national defense money, if that's where he would get the money from to build the fence, should go to national defense. But, you know, I hope that Democrats will come to the table. I mean, right now they're just saying no, they won't even come to the negotiating table.
That is Congresswoman Debbie Lesko, who represents Arizona's 8th Congressional District, Republican. Congresswoman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, 30,000 teachers in Los Angeles are preparing to go on strike as soon as tomorrow if the teachers union, United Teachers LA, and the LA Unified School District aren't able to reach an agreement today. Here's United Teachers Los Angeles President Alex Caputo-Pearl speaking Monday after a long day of negotiations that ended in a stalemate.
Unless something changes pretty significantly, there will be a strike in the city of LA.
It would be the first teacher strike in L.A. in 30 years. It's the second largest school district in the country. Joining us now is Kyle Stokes, an education reporter at KPCC. Hi, Kyle.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So there have been spending and budget problems in the L.A. Unified School District. L.A. spends half as much per student on average as the country's largest school district. That would be New York City. Does this potential teacher strike come out of longstanding underlying issues with schools in L.A.?
Yeah, you've put your finger on the issue here. Not only is funding from the state level, it's very low. California's school per pupil funding has long ranked among the bottom of the 50 states. But the other issue here, just in the immediate term, is how the district has been budgeting and spending that money over many years. The district right now has something like $2 billion in the bank. And the district says there are a lot of reasons that money is there. But the union wants that money essentially spent on their demands. They want that money put into the classroom to things like class size reductions, to more nurses, librarians, counselors, as well as to, you know, part of it for a salary increase. That is part of what's on the table. The district says that they do have plans to spend that money, but they can't spend all of it on the teachers' union demands. They have to spend it on regular operating expenses in order to keep the district in the black in the coming years. The union just doesn't buy that. They have heard for a long time that the district is, you know, sort of circling the drain financially, and yet they've been building up this $2 billion, nearly $2 billion reserve during the entire time that the district has been making these grim financial predictions.
Okay, so the union says we need all of these things. The district says we can't afford all of these things. So how is the district preparing for a strike, and what is it telling students and parents?
Well, so the district is going to have schools open, but obviously without teachers and possibly without even as well some of the sort of office staff who are part of a different union, some of them might not be there as well. The district is planning to send out something like 2,000 administrators from their central offices, from sort of bureaucratic positions, out to schools to staff them to make sure that students will have adults to supervise them while they're there. The district has also hired something like 400 non-union subs. This is sort of the question I think that parents are trying to confront. Am I going to feel safe sending my children into this environment? There are a lot of parents who don't have any other option. But there are also a lot of parents who are not going to send their kids across the picket line, essentially, because they're going to be teachers picketing right outside saying, you know, don't come into these schools. And so the district is saying, yes, we will be open. We'll offer before and after school programs, the same school meals as usual. But I think the district concedes that it's likely that attendance is going to go way down.
That is Kyle Stokes, education reporter at KPCC, as we stand by for a possible strike in Los Angeles in the schools, the first teacher strike there in 30 years. Kyle, thank you.
You betcha.
And we want to note a moment in the battle against cancer. According to a report from the American Cancer Society, cancer death rates overall have been dropping for at least 25 years. The rate dropped 27% between 1991 and 2016, meaning about 2.6 million fewer cancer deaths than expected during that period. Yay. But there are some outliers to the trend. The number of prostate cancer deaths is no longer dropping. It's flat. And the number of obesity-related cancer deaths is rising. Dr. Daryl Gray is Deputy Director of the Center for Cancer Health Equity at Ohio State University. Dr. Gray, your thoughts about the overall drop. Can we assume the campaign against smoking has played a part here?
Absolutely. So this is good news, as you highlighted, that we are making progress, particularly for those cancers that are amenable to prevention, lifestyle, and screening strategies. And particularly you highlighted smoking. Yes, that is contributing to a decline not only in lung cancer, but other smoking-related cancers such as breast cancer and colorectal cancer. And as I mentioned, you know, those cancers for which we have good screening strategies, such as for colorectal cancer screening, breast cancer screening with mammography, we are making significant progress, and we have, and I expect will continue to do so. But also, as you highlighted, there are other cancers that we have to be mindful of improving cancer mortality and death rates.
Yeah, let's take a look at that as well. The deaths from prostate cancer were also dropping for two decades. I think the rate was halved over two decades. Now it's flattened out. Why do you think that is?
There are a couple of reasons, and you highlight prostate cancer, but there are other cancers for which the death rates are increasing, such as uterine or brain, as well as pancreas cancer. And I think for all of those, you know, we need better strategies for screening, identifying those who are at high risk for developing those cancers, but also better prevention strategies as well. And this is a growing area of research, and particularly I know there are a lot of investigators who are out there trying to reverse this trend that we're seeing.
Well, let's take them one at a time. Prostate, for instance. Some researchers, according to the Associated Press, are wondering whether the trend might have changed because of a 2011 decision by the Preventive Services Task Force to stop recommending routine testing of men using the PSA blood test. Is that sparking anything within you that perhaps?
Yes, certainly that is controversial. And I think what we've learned over time is, number one, one of the best identifiers for those who might be at high risk for developing prostate cancer is family history. So it's important not only that folks who are at risk or even not at risk for prostate cancer know their history and can discuss that with their healthcare provider, but that also healthcare providers be attuned to those risk factors and then recommend appropriate guideline-based screening.
And according to the Cancer Society report, poor women have twice as many deaths from cervical cancer as affluent women do. Lung cancer mortality is far more prevalent, 40% higher in poor men compared to affluent men. So it sounds like getting messaging out about pre-screening, about stopping smoking, has to get to all communities.
Absolutely. And we've known this, particularly in public health circles for a while, that social determinants of health, and social determinants, I mean those conditions in which people are born, live, work, play, pray, and thrive, impact their health and their ability to get access to services, such as having a primary care provider, having access to cancer screening, and then utilizing it. Because for many, they're not even receiving the messages. They don't understand why it's important to get it. And if they even do get the message, they may have competing priorities, such as, you know, keeping the lights on in their house or paying the bills or getting the kids to school, that prevent them or present barriers to them actually getting age-appropriate guideline-based screening.
And just briefly, obesity, the rate of cancer in the obese is rising, not just staying flat like prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So are we seeing more of a correlation between obesity and cancers, or are cancers not able to be detected as well in people who are obese? What's happening there?
Yeah, it's multifactorial. At least two-thirds of the United States is overweight and obese. This is an epidemic. And we know that obesity does contribute to cancer. And what we've been understanding with research is that it's via kind of inflammation. So obesity can lead to inflammation that ultimately leads to development of cancer through a kind of cascade of events. And so we know that, particularly for colorectal cancer, breast cancer, other cancers,
liver
that
cancer.
Obesity can contribute.
Liver cancer deaths have been increasing initially because of hepatitis C infections, now obesity.
Yes, whereas the old adage used to be, you know, if you're going to see people coming in with cirrhosis, which means chronic scarring of the liver or needing a transplant, those are going to be primarily those with hepatitis C infections. But we're seeing that NASH, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which is a fancy word of saying fatty liver, ultimately leading to development of end-stage liver disease, and which can be a risk factor for cancer, that is increasing dramatically.
That's Dr. Daryl Gray, Deputy Director of the Center for Cancer Health Equity at Ohio State University, on the new report from the American Cancer Society. Overall cancer rates dropping, great news, but rising in the obese, and stubborn flattening out on prostate cancer. We'll keep following this. Dr. Gray, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.